Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's show, for the first part of the hour, we will replay from our January 6th show. Host Keith Brownell talks with Edward Pennington, Jeffrey Scott, and Willie Copeland, three men who were recently released from prison. They'll talk about their prison experiences and discuss their transition back into society. On the second part of the hour, host Elise Max talks with Steve Nirenberg, attorney and organizer for Never Again KC, and Jared Goldstein, organizer for Never Again Rhode Island and associate dean for academic affairs at Roger Williams University School of Law. They will discuss the role of United Missouri Bank in the detention of immigrants. United Missouri Bank represents the bondholders of the Wyatt Detention Center in Central Falls, Rhode Island, where over 100 immigrant detainees are currently housed. United Missouri Bank is suing the city of Central Falls for $130 million to keep the facility open after the municipality moved to stop jailing immigrants. Activists from the organization Never Again in Kansas City and Rhode Island are working together to put pressure on United Missouri Bank to withdraw their lawsuit. Very good radio. Stay tuned. But first, Keith Brownell.
Willie Copeland, Edward Pennington, and Jeffrey Scott are three individuals who will spend a significant portion of their lives in the Missouri penal system and have recently returned to society. We will be hearing from them today about some of the experiences they've had while incarcerated in the DOC and the challenges they now face after being released. Willie will be talking about the disadvantages some of the prisoners face in trying to pursue a college education while confined in the Department of Corrections. Edward Pennington will be sharing his concerns and the concerns of many others about medical neglect many prisoners often face and are subjected to while in confinement. Jeffrey Scott will be talking to us about how being arrested and convicted as a juvenile led him to be wrongfully incarcerated and spending 40 years in prison. My name is Keith Brownell. I am your host. Good morning, gentlemen. And first of all, let me say welcome back to society and welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Thank you.
Jeffrey, I think we probably might need to start with you. Would you like to explain to us how your situation came about and how you finally ended up being able to get out of that situation?
Okay, well, in my situation, it all began when me and another individual was arrested. But he was a juvenile as well. He was taken into custody without his parent or guardian being present, thus constituting an illegal statement under a case called Wong Song, Fruits of the Poisonous Tree. Mm-hmm. However, they used an illegal statement from my allegedly co-defendant against me. Mm-hmm. So juvenile filed a petition against me and charged me with first-degree murder. Mm-hmm. As I'm in the Jackson County Jail for the first-degree murder, they allegedly certified me. My sister guardian showed up for a hearing on 3481. The said hearing was continued to 41581. However, said hearing was held on 4881 without no notice being sent to my guardian, letting them know that the date had changed. No notice was sent to the alleged counsel who was supposed to have been appointed to represent me, and I never received notice. I was in the old Jackson County Jail, and I got a witness here, Penrod, and I never left the jail to go to the detention hearing.
And that would be Edward Pennington, this guy that's here right now.
Okay. Yeah, so I never left to go to this hearing as a juvenile. However, they certified me without none of this. So it was a situation where the court didn't have personal jurisdiction. That's what they call it when they don't give notice under their law. However, they tried me and convicted me for the amended charge of capital murder. And I went to the penitentiary, and I stayed in there for 40 years. And I just got out on the 12th of December. After doing 40 years.
And I want to point out that I know of similar situations that like that that existed even before that happened in your situation. It's been a law, at least I know, since 1971. You know, so they can't claim that this was something that they just became aware of, because if you're going to sit on the bench and you're going to send people to prison or you're going to prosecute cases, you're supposed to know what the law is. So the court assumes or supposed to assume that they know what they're doing when they do these things. But a lot of times they don't, or they just don't care. They think you don't know and they try to get away with it. And, I'm so sorry that happened to you. That was 40 years is a nice little chunk out of your life.
Yeah. It was all fraud the way they did it. Mm-hmm. Because they knew that because the statement from the alleged co-defendant was illegally obtained, then he never got charged. He never did an hour in the jail. Mm-hmm. As soon as he said my name or whatever, they let him go home. Mm-hmm. But see, under law, what applied to him applied to me. So they knew that they was not supposed to do anything to me, but leave me alone.
Have you encountered any other cases like that while you were in prison where people were in that same kind of situation?
Well, yeah, I ran into some people, but it was not, you know, it didn't fit square into the same kind of, you know what I'm saying, similar, but not exact. So I couldn't really, you know, get into their thing, you know, real heavy, because mine was such a unique situation, you know what I'm saying. Nobody else, I didn't run into nobody who had been, they rap partner was a juvenile and they made a statement that was illegal and so forth and so on. And I didn't encounter nobody like that.
And a lot of times when you get into these situations, you have, if you got a person that's a juvenile, it's chances are like he's never been in any trouble before. And they get down there and they get you down there and they tell you, well, you caught up in the system now, ain't nobody coming to your rescue, nobody's going to help you. Right. If you want to help yourself, the best thing you can do is cooperate with us, and they coerce statements out of you and a lot of things, and those things get used. It's criminal how they just let these people who are supposed to uphold the law break the law at will and do the things that they do just to get people convicted. Now, I'm going to come back later on. I'm going to, you know, talk to you a little bit about how you've been doing since you got out and, the different struggles you've had. I'm sure you've had some since trying to get situated. Let's go over here to Mr. Penrod and talk about some of the situations that you've encountered while you were incarcerated.
Well, the main thing I want to discuss is the the lack of health care in prison. I mean, the system, I think it's Corizon that's run. Actually, the same system has been running the prison, the hospital. They change their name after they get sued so many times and they do so much stuff. They change their name and come back as the same group of people over and over. They just change the name and come back as a different corporation. But I have seen too much death. So many people have died in prison because they have been misdiagnosed, because the prison, the health care provider doesn't want to spend the money to treat people. I've seen several guys die of cancer. We all know several other guys like Cornelius Johnson.
You're saying they've been intentionally misdiagnosed?
Intentionally misdiagnosed. They claim a guy will come to you, like if something's wrong with me, I'll go and say, hey, something's wrong with me. And they say, well, we can't find it. We can't find what's wrong with you. And I say, well, can you send me out? You know, if a person doesn't have any outside help, anybody on the outside to call central office and complain to the director or somebody at central office to get them some assistance, then the medical people, whatever institution they are, they just won't do anything.
Oh, you can get some aspirin.
Yeah. A Band-Aid. Yeah. And I've seen it over and over again, because the medical health care provider, they get a contract and they get so much money. They provide the minimum care so that they can make keep the rest of the money and give it out as bonuses at the end of the year or for whatever reason, whatever they have, you know, what do they do with the rest of the money, but they don't spend it on the prisoner's care. And I've seen a lot of people being misdiagnosed, you know, and it's a big problem. And like I said, if you don't have, you know, and the thing about it, most people in society, they don't really pay attention. I mean, they struggling too. And
some of them don't really care.
They really don't care. The only people that care about prisoners are prisoners' families most of the time, you know. And we can get in touch with some of the representatives sometime and get them involved, you know, and make it. But usually that doesn't happen until, like, in time when elections come up. Then everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon, you know. But it's an ongoing problem in prison. And another problem is the legal system in there. Those are my two biggest problems with prison. Health care, because a guy, you know, you may not survive prison to get out.
Exactly.
You know, you may not make it to your out date if you do have an out date because of the health care. And then working on your case, guys come in there with big sentences. And like when I was in prison, I was a paralegal, and I tried to help as many guys as I could. They have rules now where they wrote me up, give me a violation for assisting guys in prison. They won't let you help a guy in prison, and they don't have any trained paralegals or anybody. A guy just comes. If I come to prison now and I don't know anything about the law, I've just been, you know, the public defender was working on my case, and I get to prison, then there's nobody there to help me work on my case. I don't know anything about it.
And prisoners come, they stunned.
Yeah.
Because you get these big sentences, and you be stunned. So the only thing which you come through the door really identifying is cards and basketball and maybe chess. So you go and do what you know, and instead of having somebody who can help you, they are curtailing you. They are prohibiting prisoners from helping each other, even though the Supreme Court of the United States said that prisoners can help each other with their cases. But you'll get a violation for assisting when you have the right, even under the Constitution or Supreme Court law, saying you can.
And the Department of Correction will not recognize your right, because the only way to uphold your right, you can file a grievance all you want to, but nothing ever happens to the grievance, because, I mean, that's just a sham so that you can file a lawsuit. And who has $400 to file a lawsuit to protect their rights when you're poor anyway, you know?
I like to add to that. I actually had a caseworker tell me, why would they let you out of prison when they make money on you? So one of the reasons why, it's a method to their madness, but to them it makes perfectly good sense. If, you know, under the Bill Clinton administration, lock them up, throw away the key. So they was getting so many dollars a year for each prisoner. I think it's like $40,000 a year for each prisoner. So why would they want me to help myself and get out of prison, and I'm taking money out of their pocket? So that's one of the reasons why they violate the United States law and causing people to just rot in prison.
Well, there's also another reason. So many rational and sensible judges have been replaced in the federal judicial system. And a lot of these politicians now, they're challenging many long-standing decisions that have governed this country for decades. And the reason they're doing this is because they think they have enough conservative judges on the bench now, and they certainly have enough on the United States Supreme Court where they feel like these decisions can be challenged and they can be overturned and they can institute a new way of doing things, you know. And a lot of people just, they simply don't pay attention when they have these hearings and these nominations. I think maybe we had a lot of problems or issues or people that had differences when they tried to put Kavanaugh on the court, but he ended up being on the court anyway.
Confirmed, yeah, exactly.
You know, and once they knew they had a conservative majority, they are challenging abortion rights now and everything. Once they knew they had enough conservative judges on the Supreme Court, they felt like whatever was law, it don't matter anymore because we're going to put some new law on the books and it's going to be the way we want it done.
And that's what's happening. We have a conservative, a very conservative president, and everything is rolling downhill now. He's putting in all these conservative judges, and they're changing the law from what it used to be. And people, I mean, it's changing every day, and it's so getting more and
it's rolling it back.
Yeah, that's you what know, they're doing. That's
said exactly they want to make America great again. Some old coin.
Well, you think about the laws; they were never written in stone anyway. So the Supreme Court sets the law of the land, so they have a right to reverse whatever law they want to reverse, and that's what we're doing. We roll it back in time, so to speak.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the educational concerns you had?
Yeah, one of the things about prison, if you actually want to change an individual, you first have to change the way that he think. And so if you're not properly educating individuals, then you basically are not changing them. So up under the Bill Clinton administration, when he instituted the lock him up, throw away the key era, he took away all of the education from prisons. It was strictly about punishment. Now it's headed back to reform. And so they got a policy now that if you want to be educated, like when I was there, I paid for my own college courses, you know, and they gave you problems with that, you know. And even though you're paying yourself, they still gave you problems about it. So now they instituting college back to the institutions.
Pell grants and stuff.
Pell grants and everything. But the problem with that is you got a lot of guys in prison that have a lot of time. So when they do 25, 30, 35 years and they go up for parole, they usually get an out date within 18 months or so. But the way they got the policy set up now, you have to be within 10 years of your date to take advantage of the educational programs they got in college now. So guys that's been locked up 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years don't get a chance to take advantage of these college courses. And so that's something that I think that we need to talk about and try to get DOC to change that policy. Because if you stay locked up 25 or 30 years and they just let you go without any training, any education, you defeat the purpose. You're setting the individual up for failure. So you got people that's just coming to prison, able to take advantage of this, and I think it's a miscarriage of justice for guys that's been locked up for, you know, 25, 30, 40 years of their lives.
So the only people that are really able to take advantage of that kind of situation is that they have to be within 10 years.
10 years of their release date.
Of their release date.
And so a guy that's been locked up a long time, for example, myself, I did 29 years and 9 months. And so when you get an out date at 18 months, you have to be in the program, you have to have at least 2 years left to complete an AA degree. And most guys have been locked up a long time. Their release date, when they do get a parole release date, it's going to be within 18 months or less. So they don't get a chance to take advantage of the programs. And another thing, all of the programs that can really help an individual grow and change, become a different individual, they in lower level camps. So guys with a lot of time never get a chance to take advantage of these programs.
And that's a problem too, because guys like myself, I have a life sentence. You never get within 10, because you never get out there unless you see the parole board and on the paperwork, and where guys have 25 years and maybe he's done 15, he's within 10 years left on a life sentence. It says 9999. So you don't have a number that they can calculate. You have 999.
So when you go before the parole board, after you've done 25, 30 years, they give you basically an immediate out date, 18 months or less, in most cases.
And you got to have 2 years or whatever to be able to get in the program.
AA degree is 2 years, a 2 year program.
But if you under that,
you can't get in the program.
Exactly. How much time did you serve on your life sentence, Pete Brown?
Wow, I've been doing this life on installment plan for almost 40 years. Let's see, 81. I came in June of 81. I made parole in April of 2002. And unfortunately, I violated and came back. I stayed out for 9 years, came back in 2011, and I just got out again from doing 8 years, 8 months, and 8 days, exactly. So that's like 30 years, and then, you know, and you not counting about the time on parole.
You was one of the lucky ones that got a break in between that 30 years.
Exactly.
What I've been noticing now, I keep asking myself the question, what happened to the idea about returning people who have been to prison to society to allow them to become productive citizens? Everybody that I'm talking to now that gets out of prison, if they had any substantial amount of time, they spent anywhere from 30 to 40 years in prison. And when they come out of prison, they in wheelchairs or they are otherwise disabled. You know, you don't have educational opportunities or anything. They talk about how much it costs to keep people confined in prison per day, but they never tell you how much money they make off keeping people confined.
Exactly. It's just like Willie was saying, though, Brownell, the mentality was lock them up and throw away the key. And I'm saying by the time guys like Junkyard, 40 years, you know, he was a juvenile when he got, I mean, you know, are you saying he's not rehabilitatable? You know, you just throw him away. And this is the mentality that the prison system was in. And like Willie said, hopefully it's swinging back now more towards rehabilitation. And that's basically because they're running out of money. They already said that they spend $80 billion to incarcerate people in this country. And I don't know if that's just on the federal system or all the way across the board for the country, but that's, you know, that's money that they've been taking from schools. You know, that's why so many kids are going to prison, because they're not putting the money in education in the first place.
Well, one of the things is people give Bill Clinton a lot of credit for the economic boom in the 90s. Well, actually, it didn't have anything to do with him. It was the technological boom that took place, and he just happened to be there. And so that's where it came about, lock him up and throw away the key. You know, they've been mass incarceration up under his watch. And now Donald Trump is in there, and he said, look, we're not going to continue to support prisons. And so it's swinging back to reform, and they're more willing to let people out of prison.
But my hope is that it'll continue to do that. But my concern is that once they accumulate enough money where they can continue to run prisons as they have ran them in the past, it'll go right back to being the same thing. You know, we have to keep emphasizing the fact that they're not doing this because they had a change of heart.
Right.
They're doing it because the economic situation dictates that they have to do this.
Yes.
And I want to thank each of you for coming in today and sharing your insight with our audience. I hope people out there are listening and they're paying attention, because this system has to change. The criminal justice system is wrecking this country. So-called criminal justice system. A person that spends 30 or 40 years in prison is no good to society if he comes out and then he has to be on disability for the rest of his life. You know, so I hope you'll continue to promote your ideas and your messages, whether you're on the radio station or not, because people need to know these things. And thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The other media does a good job of reporting on business. You get a lot about the market, CEOs, and even corporate scandals. But where's the news about the rest of us, the working people? What's it like to deliver mail or build a car? You get that right here on KKFI, on the Heartland Labor Forum. We cover the lives of working people, our jobs, unions, the laws they pass that affect us, and what happens to us when businesses screw up. Tune in Thursdays at 6 p.m. We broadcast Fridays at 5 a.m.
Did you know your business or organization could be sponsoring this episode of Jaws of Justice Radio? Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Good morning. You are listening to KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Elise Max. I'm here today hosting a show talking about Never Again Action in Kansas City and Rhode Island. We are in the studio today with Kansas City organizer Steve Nierenberger. And on the phone we have Jared Goldstein from Rhode Island, a Never Again organizer in Rhode Island. Are you with us here, Jared?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us today. So we are going to talk about Never Again Action, specifically about the role of UMB Bank in the detention of immigrants and how we have been organizing with the Rhode Island chapter to develop a campaign against UMB for their investments and for their lawsuit against the town of Central Falls, Rhode Island, oversee the Wyatt Detention Center. So thank you both for being with us. You're both involved with the organization Never Again. Can you start out just by telling me a little bit of background about the organization and maybe what's the mission of the organization?
Who do you want to go first?
You can go first, Jared.
Okay, hi. Well, thanks for having me on the show. So Never Again Action is a group that was started just last summer to protest immigration detention. It's organized primarily, though not exclusively, by Jews who are upset by our country's immigration policies and see parallels between immigration and especially the detention of undocumented immigrants and people seeking refugee status and the Holocaust. And since Jews so strongly believe that what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s should never happen again, we feel an obligation to stand up to stop anything like it from ever happening here, you know, so that if we're holding immigrants, you know, because we see them as other, because we hate them, because we see them as, threatening our society, you know, you start putting them in camps, and we know, you know, from our experience as Jews, where that can lead. So we've organized to try to stop immigration detention across the country, and I got involved in Rhode Island last summer. We have a detention center in Central Falls, Rhode Island, called the Wyatt Detention Center, which is kind of complicated story, but it's a detention facility that has a contract with ICE and holds about 100 ICE detainees, primarily people who came over from the southern border seeking the same life that you and I live here in this country. And the Wyatt Detention Center is run, in actuality, by the UMB Bank, because it represents the bondholders, that is, private investors who are trying to make money off contracts with ICE for immigration detention. So I got involved last summer in this movement. But it's not just, you know, in Rhode Island or in Kansas City. It's a movement all over the country. People have been protesting. You know, Jews have been organizing across the country to protest our nation's immoral immigration policies.
Great. Thank you. Anything to add to that about Never Again or the organization in Kansas City?
No. Other than locally, we participated in an action with the folks in Rhode Island and as well in San Diego in mid-December. So there was a direct action in front of the United Missouri Bank's headquarters downtown. At the same time, I think some folks in San Diego participated in a direct action involving some physicians as well, and as well as the folks back up in Rhode Island. Like I said, in December, we were carrying on a campaign against United Missouri Bank locally, until they disgorge themselves from this involvement of profiting off of detainees and refugees in the prison in Rhode Island.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the lawsuit, because I think it's complicated and a little bit difficult to understand. The response by UMB has largely been, well, we're not involved in the day-to-day operations of the facility, and we have this fiduciary agreement. We absolutely cannot drop the lawsuit. It's because of our bondholders. So can we kind of deconstruct that just a little bit? How is UMB connected explicitly to this this order of ICE to detain immigrants in Wyatt Detention Center. I noticed that Wyatt is a quasi-public correctional facility. How is that different, and how is UMB's role explicit there?
Well, if we go back, you know, to the 1990s when the Wyatt was created, so it is a quasi-public entity. That is, it's a municipal corporation created by the state of Rhode Island in Central Falls, the purpose of which was to try to make money for Central Falls. They thought the city could make some money by creating a detention facility, making contracts with the federal government to hold not just immigration detainees, but all sorts of federal detainees. If Central Falls is a very poor city in Rhode Island, I think, you know, that is immigrant majority, and they saw it as a money maker. About 10 years later, they weren't making quite as much money off of the prison as they thought they would, so they decided to expand it. And the way that they financed the expansion of the prison was by issuing bonds, $100 million in bonds to private investors who were guaranteed a return on that investment, you know, for investing in this quasi-public detention facility, you know, who gets contracts with the federal government. So now the Wyatt is on the hook for $100 million to these private investors, mostly institutional investors. It turns out, you know, they still can't make enough, you know, as much money as it takes to pay off those bonds, and they're essentially in default. But rather than bringing an action to, say, foreclose on the Wyatt, what the bondholders have done was to get agreements with the Wyatt under which they do various things to try to maximize their profits, you know, to try to make as much on their return as they can to pay off these bonds, that is, to pay off the investors who they owe all this money to. So then back in April, the Wyatt made a contract with ICE. They hadn't had a contract with ICE for about a dozen years, since an ICE detainee died, or I should say was killed in custody through torture and some other horrible means. This man's name was Jason Ng, and ICE eventually cut their contracts with the Wyatt. But now they have a new contract with the Wyatt, and when the Wyatt board, which is appointed by the city of Central Falls, tried to get out of the contract with ICE because they don't want immigration detention in their city. It's contrary to their values, and they don't want it happening there. So when the Wyatt board tried to get out of the contract with ICE, tried to rescind the contract, UMB Bank brought suit on behalf of all the bondholders to require the Wyatt to keep its contract with ICE. So because they say, you owe us all this money, and you have to do whatever it takes to pay it off, and if that means contracts with ICE, so be it. We don't care about the morality of immigration detention. We want our money. So that's what UMB Bank did. Now, of course, you know, for them to say, you know, they have no choice, is just to say, you know, all we care about is, you know, the money that's owed to our investors. We don't care how you make it. So that if ICE came in tomorrow and said, we're going to start building crematoria and gas chambers, the bondholders' point of view is to say, well, if that's what it takes to pay off the debt, so be it. That is, morality just doesn't enter into the picture for them. And so they brought suit to require the Wyatt to keep its contract with ICE, even though the city doesn't want it, even though the board of the Wyatt doesn't want it either. And the federal judge ultimately agreed with them and issued an injunction saying that the Wyatt, because of its obligation to pay off these debts, has to do what it takes, and if that means ICE contracts, so be it. So that's where things stand in the lawsuit in a nutshell.
So I guess I have a follow-up question. If the Wyatt board did not enter the contract with ICE, who exactly signed that contract with ICE if the quasi-public board wasn't in agreement with it? How did that contract happen?
The board did sign the contract with ICE, and then they tried to rescind it.
Okay.
And when they tried to get out of it, was when the UMB brought suit, and the federal court ruled that they couldn't get out of it.
Okay.
But the same would probably be true. Well, it might be true if they had decided from the beginning not to enter the contract. UMB could still have brought suit and said, you need to make a contract with ICE. Of course, their position wouldn't have been quite as strong as if they were trying to rescind the contract. But either way, their position, the UMB's position is the White has to do whatever it takes to pay off their investors.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is the ask of Never Again in Rhode Island? Like, when they're protesting at the detention facility, what is the ask? Do they just want to close down the facility? Do they want, the board is already kind of on the same page. So what's the ask there at the Wyatt during the protests?
Well, we do want to shut down the Wyatt. We think the Wyatt is not doing any good. And the whole idea of trying to make money off of people suffering is just immoral. But in the more specifically, what we want is to end immigration detention in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
To get ICE out of Rhode Island, and because we think the immigration policies as they're currently implemented are immoral, and we don't want any of it happening here or anywhere. So we would like for the Wyatt to end its contract with ICE. Now, the Wyatt board eventually did ratify the contract, mostly under threat of the lawsuit. So we're not exactly on the same page with them. We thought we went to their board meetings and we disrupted one board meeting, and then another board meeting we testified. I've testified twice before the Wyatt board. They have public meetings to try to get them to not go along with what UMB Bank wants them to do. But mostly what we want is for them to end immigration detention in Rhode Island, to get ICE out of Rhode Island, and to end all cooperation with ICE in the state.
Great. I think that's a great great ask there. What about in Kansas City? Has there been any communication with UMB? What is the ask of UMB? I know there was a protest on December 10th. And so tell me a little bit about that target, and has there been any movement there?
So the idea here, the ask is for United Missouri Bank to remove themselves as the trustee on behalf of the bondholders. They are the third successor of trustees for that. There have been other banks and institutions involved in this role. They claim they have this obligation. Somehow they're forced as if their hands are tied, but in reality, they're just serving their fiduciary role. They can ask off of it if they'd like. They can certainly advocate a different role for the facility. There's other ways to figure out bed space or figure out some other use for this investment that they're involved in. So, our ask is to ask for them to remove themselves from their involvement.
I think, too, when you think about UMB is suing the city of Central Falls for $130 million. These are 100 detainees that are happening, by ICE. Is that going to compensate them for their $130 million loss? I just wonder what is UMB benefiting? What are they benefiting, off of entering into this agreement? Is it symbolic? Are they making a bunch of money off of these bondholders? Because these 100 detainees couldn't certainly be reimbursing the town to the tune of $130 million. So it's kind of rhetorical, because you probably don't know either. But
the bondholders are never going to recoup the investment.
Yeah.
It was a bad investment to begin with. That is, the idea that you're going to make that kind of money off of federal detention turned out to have been a mistake. They're hoping to get, I don't know, what do they want? 50 cents on the dollar. They want to get out of the, they want to recoup as much on their investment as they can. And so they want to make sure that the Wyatt is run in a way that they can at least get back as much as they possibly can. And if that means, immigration detention, great, whatever it is, they just want the Wyatt run to maximize profit.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that the UMB could do, even if it's not willing to step out of its role as trustee, because of course that might just give the problem to someone else who's willing to do exactly the same thing as UMB is doing. UMB could work with the city of Central Falls and the Wyatt to run the operations in a way that's consistent with the values of the city where they exist. If the city of Central Falls doesn't want immigration detention there, I would hope that the UMB Bank would care about that. That they think that there's some role for the city to have a say in what goes on in this prison that, you know, is operated in their jurisdiction, and that's at least nominally a city institution. So I would hope that UMB Bank would work with the city and work with the community to try to come to a solution so that they're not the ones who are forcing the city to accept, you know, this detention that the community posts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Have you seen any movement in that way, or has it been pretty much just a lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any movement in that direction. I mean, there's some other things that are, you know, there are a lot of other activities happening, you know, from our side here in Rhode Island. I mean, we're working on legislation before the the state legislature right now to try to prohibit any new contracts with ICE. I don't think we can do anything I don't think that we're likely to get any action to try to rescind the current contract, but Rhode Island, like California and like Washington, could prohibit any entity within the state to enter into any new contracts with ICE. We're trying to get Rhode Island to pass legislation like that. We're also trying to get them to prohibit private prisons within the state, because one of the things that the bondholders want, and that UMB has made clear in the lawsuit as well as in their agreements with the Wyatt, is that they'd like to privatize the Wyatt. That is, to sell it to one of these private prison corporations so that there wouldn't be any public oversight at all. And that, I think from the bondholders' point of view, probably is their best option to get paid, you know, I don't know, 50 or 60 cents on the dollar that they invested, is if they could sell the Wyatt. But we don't want that to happen either, because we don't want a private prison that has no public oversight here. Those are have the worst track records in terms of human rights of any prison. So we're trying to get the legislature to do, again, what California and Washington and Illinois have done, and a couple of other states, to prohibit any private prisons within the state. So we're working that angle. There are some other organizations in town. We work with a bunch of, you know, other community groups that work on immigration issues. Another group in town called Amor has been trying to work with the investors in the Wyatt to try to convince them to work with the community and to listen to community concerns. The Rhode Island treasurer just sent a letter to Invesco, one of the chief investors the UMB represents, to try to convince them to listen to the community and to drop their requirement that they continue the contract with ICE. So we're working, you know, at many different levels with the legislature, with to try to work with the investors, to try to pressure UMB Bank, because I assume that they don't want their name to be in the news for this reason, right? That is, if the UMB Bank board, you know, I assume that they're going to start getting annoyed, start getting embarrassed that in the public's eye, they start getting associated with making money and profits off of people suffering. I assume that they'll want out. So we're trying to, you know, pressure them, pressure the state, and pressure the investors in every way we can.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. I mean, you would think that UMB Bank would not want to be associated with detention and deportation. So one thing I've noticed from the Kansas City action on the 10th and the campaign of actions happening in Wyatt is they seem to be really aggressive, kind of hyper-militarized. And I know, I believe I read that at one point a protester in Wyatt was run over by a van. Can you talk a little bit about that response? And then I want to hear about what happened in Kansas City as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly. Well, here's what happened. I was there at that protest. We were protesting at the Wyatt. You know, it was a group of, you know, I don't know, 500 or more peaceful protesters. You know, I was there with my wife and my kids. And there were plenty of people who were there, college age kids, older people. You know, and we were sitting and singing and, you know, chanting. And we were, you know, trying to close down the operations of the Wyatt. It was a civil disobedience action, but peaceful. But we were sitting in, some of us were sitting in the crosswalk, that's the entrance to the employee parking lot, when one of the guards, an employee at the Wyatt, drove his his truck into the crowd. He pulled right up in front of us, stopped, and the crowd started screaming, and then he hit the gas again and drove into the crowd. Several people were hurt. One person's leg was might have been broken. At least that's what one of the news reports said. The Wyatt guards came out and pepper sprayed the crowd, pushed us all out of the way. Then there was a long state investigation and a grand, which ultimately led to the grand jury deciding not to bring any charges against the driver or the pepper spraying guards, which was a travesty of justice. But that's what happened, is that one of the guards decided to drive his truck into the crowd and protesters that night, and then he called his buddies, who pushed us out of the way and sprayed us with chemical agents.
Wow, that's pretty aggressive. And tell me a little bit about what happened in Kansas City. I know there was an event on December 10th.
Yeah, so United Missouri Bank decided to shut themselves down for the day. So we were there for a direct action. There were participants who sat down on some steps outside the bank, and the police that were there were just cops of folks in full military getup, as if there was some sort of war effort, Tommy guns or some type of automatic rifles, bullet belts, all types of gear that you wouldn't expect in a city. We were there protesting and doing what citizens do when they're appalled by a banker for Trump's eyes. And then the police went ahead and arrested about seven participants for, somehow blocking a bank that was already shut down for the day by their own actions, by their own voluntary actions.
So it was a pretty aggressive approach for, about how many protesters do you think were there?
There might have been 30 of us and probably police folks, maybe 70 to 80. Over, way too much.
We only have a couple minutes left, so I do want to give our listeners a chance to learn about how to get involved with their local Never Again. In case anyone's listening in Rhode Island, Jared, will you tell folks how they can find you on the web or if you have regular meetings?
We do have regular meetings. We have a Facebook page, so that's probably the easiest thing, at Never Again Action Rhode Island. People can sign up. We have training sessions for nonviolence action. We have a legislative team who's working on lobbying the state, and we have social events too. We have Shabbat dinners. Anyone who's interested, please sign up on the Facebook page and find out what's happening. We want to spread the word.
Great, thanks. And Steve, what's going on in KC for people who want to get involved?
So our next meeting will be March 1st. So we'd love folks to seek us out and go to the next meeting. You can find us again at Facebook, Instagram, and also Twitter. There's a Never Again Kansas City or KC spot for us, and you can sign up there. We'd really appreciate it.
Well, thank you both for joining us this morning to talk about the connection between UMB Bank and the Wyatt Detention Center. We'll look forward to having you both back when we have some progress and some movement. So thanks again for your time, and it was nice speaking with you, Jared and Steve.
Thank you.
The Reverend Most High, we got a great show lined up for you with our good friend, Dr. Melamede. Here we go. He's an old friend of mine, been on the show many times over the decades, and his backwards-looking individual and forward-looking individual may give you a reminder of who we're going to be speaking with, but Dr. Robert Melamede is with us now. Hey, Doc, how you doing?
I'm good, Dean. How are you? My pleasure and honor to be on your show. It's so nice that people have to understand how important the ending of this drug war and this nonsense really is.
Well, and thank you, Robert. And let's give the folks a little bit of background, a little bit of your resume, if you will, please, for the listeners.
Well, I started out as an old hippie. I was a young college student, 16. I started college, and I was lost in space, totally, because I'm very ADD. And I used cannabis to self-reflect and eventually learn how to study. And eventually, with the use of cannabis, I got my PhD in molecular genetics and biochemistry.
Brings forward a point that, you know, we hear, I don't know, the worry warts talking about, just recently, I think Trump was quoted as saying that use of marijuana lowers your IQ. And if that were true, you and I would both be vegetables out on the street corner, wouldn't we?
Along with a lot of other famous people, including, you know, Nobel laureates.
Yes. And that's the heck of it. The other side spouts rumor, innuendo, lies to continue this policy, to keep this portion of the drug war going on marijuana, right?
Well, that's the big cash cow in the whole deal, you know. Look, if realistically speaking, there's not a whole lot of people that are doing heroin, even though they're overdosing and dying, and then you see that, you know, for narcotics in general, but there's millions and millions of people using cannabis, and for a very good reason. It's good for you to use cannabis, unlike the other drugs and alcohol and tobacco and listening to the political fools. Those things are bad for you. Cannabis happens to be good for you. It's an anti-aging drug that kills cancer and inhibits all age-related illnesses.
Dr. Melamy, tell them about what's on that PDF. That's going to be our main topic of discussion, right?
Well, yeah, they can either do it by downloading or looking at your PDF, or they can go to my website, because I have the latest version. You may not have the latest version.
Well, go ahead.
And that's Cannasapiens, Canna-Sapiens, Sapiens. So Cannasapiens.com, up on top there, it says Cancer 2020 in the menu across the top there.
Part 2 tomorrow. I'm Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I going to do now? Am I going to make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com.